Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Cantor. Michigan ranks near the bottom of all 50 states when it comes to taking care of its veterans. On this Veterans Day, later in the program, we will talk with a vet who is one of the governor's campaign advisors about the progress her administration has made.
I think the question on most veterans' minds is, where is this going? What is the goal and what is the vision here? Because from a layperson's perspective, this really isn't making sense.
But first, it was 2012 when the Detroit Institute of Arts turned to voters in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties. Here was the ask: a 0.2 mills tax for 10 years. And, said museum officials, if the millage passed, the DIA did not expect to ask for a renewal. Voters said yes. And now the DIA is seeking an early renewal of that operating millage. It's hoping to get the question on the ballot in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties 2 years early. Let's find out why this step was needed and how the museum's been doing since the millage was first passed. Here with us now, Salvador Celor-Pons, who's director of the Detroit Institute of Art. Salvador, welcome.
Thank you very much.
The museum's board voted last week to seek this early renewal of the millage. Why was that?
Well, I think the museum is doing a terrific job in Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb counties, and we're providing extraordinary services to them, starting with free admission. We also provide free tours and education to the schools, and we also provide free education to seniors on Thursdays, and we have a very strong community partnership program that allow us to establish a partnership with the community colleges in the Tri-County area. We just would like to continue doing this more and more for the community. We have become a tool for the community. We're going beyond the walls of the museum. And this museum is a completely different organization than it was in 2012. And therefore, we want to continue making this work. The Tri-County allow us to be leaders in education. And we're asking the voters to look at the work that the museum does and, see if they would like to renew this partnership.
How much has the DIA's operating budget changed since 2012?
Well, in 2012, we were in a very difficult situation. Our budget was at minimum just to keep the doors open of the museum. We only had the museum open 5 days a week, and we have staff just to keep going. And with the service agreement that we have with Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb County, we were able to expand our operation to provide extraordinary services that no other museum in the country provides to any community. So it has gone from $25 million that it was to $38, but this is just to provide the service.
That $13 million increase, so that's the fact that you've been able to, with this money and this millage support, been able to increase services.
Just remember that we pay for the buses that go to the schools, and we bring to the museum every year from the Tri-County 62,000 students. In total, we bring to the museum 75,000 students. And this is, it's a big cost for us, but in a world in which arts education is being eliminated from schools, the museum has become the number one provider of arts education in the Tri-County.
As you say, we're seeing schools having to cut back on that, aren't we?
Yes, and we are helping them to continue providing this arts education through our programs. And our programs are done in a very, what I believe, smart way, because we work with the teachers in the schools to build up the curriculum in a way that it helps those schools meet their goals.
And these are all the kinds of efforts that you've been, that were not around before to the degree they are now. You've been able to do this special outreach to the Tri-County area because of, you've got more money to work with.
Well, before the millage, it was around 20,000 students. Now, it's 75,000. Needless to say, the work we do with the seniors, we do the same with the seniors, with the veterans, and many others, because we send the buses to their locations, and we bring them to the museum every Thursday, and, work with them and create opportunities in the museum where they learn about the collection, they do art themselves, and, they talk to the curators, they talk to me. It's just unbelievable. Today is Veterans Day. So we have also a very strong program with the veterans whereby they, for example, help into the creation of murals in the community that we live there in those communities for the enjoyment of those who live there and also enhancing their lives.
What are you hearing from community and county leaders, in particularly the Tri-County area where voters are going to be asked to perhaps say yes to more money? What are you hearing from leaders?
I think we have a very strong support in the community. They have realized the benefits that this millage brings to the residents. And I think the county leaders want the museum to be or to continue to be leader in education. They want to have the museum be a strong team player in the comeback of Southeast Michigan. I think the leaders in the county want the museum to continue providing experiences through exhibitions and programs that the residents cannot find on TV, in the internet, or books. I have to say that I am grateful to the residents of the community. I'm grateful to the leaders in the communities in the Tri-County because they made this museum a much better place than it was in 2012.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with the director of the Detroit Institute of Arts, Salvador Salorplans, as we talk about the museum's plans to turn to voters of the Tri-County area, Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties, and ask for an early millage renewal. And at the time that the DIA was campaigning for a yes vote back in 2012 on the millage question, officials of the museum said there would not be a request for additional millage. Instead, the focus would be on building an endowment. What's changed, and how do you answer critics who see this as perhaps going back on a promise?
We've been building the endowment at a very good pace. When museum officials asked for the millage in 2012, they didn't know two things. They didn't know that the city of Detroit was going to go bankrupt and that the museum needed to raise $100 million for the city, so it would come up out of bankruptcy. Today, thanks to that process, thanks to the endowment, to the fundraising efforts that the museum did in the past, the museum now is a public trust. We own the building, we own the collection, and we own the grounds. Also, the museum and its culture has been transformed by this millage, by this service agreement, by the school program, by the senior program, by the community partnership program, by the fact that we are free to residents of Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb County. So we just want to continue doing this work. And what we would like is that the residents see what we've done and vote, have the opportunity to vote. Also, the legislator in 2012 allowed for this millage to be for 20 years. We have only used 10 years of those 20 years that were granted to us.
So why come back for this early renewal?
Well, we are following the example of the zoo. They were in a similar situation, and they sought a renewal 2 years early. So we're just following what they did. I think we need to be thinking ahead, making sure that we can secure this service in the future. So the sooner we put this in front of the residents for them to vote, I think is the better for everyone.
And what's next now in the process to get the question on the ballot in March in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties?
So the arts authorities in Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb County need to approve this and place it on the ballot.
What is at stake here for the DIA and Southeast Michigan, the area it serves? And what happens if the question does not get on the ballot, or if it does, voters say no?
Well, if that happens, we will have to rethink our strategic plan. We will need to see what resources what we have and what kind of museum we could be.
Salvador Salorplans, who's director of the Detroit Institute of Arts. We want to thank you for spending time with us and talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Today's early snowstorm meant rough driving all over the state. And when we talk about trouble on the road, the Michigan Department of Transportation has a request regarding the word we use to describe that trouble. MDOT's Jeff Cranson is here. So, Jeff, we're talking about crash versus accident, and MDOT would like us to drop?
drop the word accident.
Why is that?
Because accident implies that something happened at random, and it wasn't because we humans did what humans do and were distracted or driving too fast for conditions or, you know, using poor judgment, which is what always causes a crash. You know, we don't call them plane accidents, although the Boeing CEO did try to say that during congressional testimony just last week. We've always said plane crashes, and we should say car crashes because that's what they are.
And so by consistently using that word crash, what are we saying?
I think it reminds us that it's our responsibility to drive safely. I remember when we had the very bad pile up a few years ago on I-94 between Kalamazoo and Battle Creek, and, you know, there were 60-some people cited in that crash for not driving for conditions. And we had a meeting about it later to do a study on the corridor with the Michigan State Police and MDOT officials. And, you know, MDOT officials take this very personally, and they're always looking for ways to make the roads safer, make our commutes safer. But I remember a retired MSP officer sitting in the back of the room, nearly jumping out of his chair saying, these crashes happened because people weren't driving for conditions. And, you know, we're all in a hurry, whether we're walking, which, as you know, pedestrian incidents are up also. We're all in a hurry. We're all distracted, and we all expect our 20-minute commute to always be 20 minutes, and we don't plan ahead, and that's on all of us. And so this is just one more way to say, you know what, it's our responsibility. It's not about assigning blame, but it's just accepting that we have to accept that we are responsible for how we drive, and if something happens, it's a crash, not an accident.
MDOT's Jeff Cranson, a timely reminder for all of us. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Sure, Cindy. Thank you.
Still to come, how has Governor Gretchen Whitmer's administration approached veterans' issues since taking office? We'll check in with a veteran and a former campaign advisor coming up in 10 minutes here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last week, the Wayne State University Board of Governors voted 4-0 in an impromptu motion to fire President Roy Wilson. The vote blindsided some members of the board, supporters of President Wilson. They walked out before the yeas and nays were taken. Now, the members of the board who voted to oust the president want Attorney General Dana Nessel to step in and decide whether the vote was legitimate. It's a messy chapter at a time when another university, Michigan State, is having its own headlines of board dysfunction as one member left and chastised the others as she exited. Here to help us get a sense of why these governing bodies are struggling is David Jesse, higher education reporter with the Detroit Free Press. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So there have been a lot of headlines pouring out of the Wayne State Board of Governors over an attempt by half the board to fire President Roy Wilson. So kind of walk us through what happened this past week with these warring factions.
So there was a board meeting. Actually, there was a committee meeting, and the whole board was there. It was a health affairs committee meeting. Wayne State has been having issues with its medical school and its affiliation with the Detroit Medical Center, and should they move to someplace else, and all kinds of issues going on. So there was a meeting about those topics. It was held behind closed doors. Michigan's Constitution allows universities to not abide by the Open Meetings Act, so they're allowed to do that. And at the end of the meeting, there was a briefing about the recently announced Detroit tuition pledge, where Wayne State said that they would cover tuition costs for anyone who graduates from high school and lives in the city of Detroit or attends a Detroit high school. So they got done with that, and the four board members who are not in favor of President Wilson decided to make a motion to fire Wilson. The other three board members got up and left, said it was not inappropriate, it wasn't a meeting, it should be done out in the open. So they left. So the four board members who were there voted affirmatively to fire Wilson. So we don't know where it is now. There's been an attorney general request for a ruling, an opinion from the attorney general on whether it was a valid meeting, and it's just a giant mess.
You know, kind of in a nutshell, this is not new. This has been building. What really led to these problems on Wayne's board?
Well, a lot of it has to do back with this contract with Detroit Medical Center. Wilson and about half the board wanted to switch their affiliation over to Henry Ford Health System, and the other folks did not want to do that. They wanted to stay with the Detroit Medical Center, and so there was all kinds of issues that kind of sprung from that.
You know, reports kind of keep oozing out as this goes on, including one that the FBI is poking around accusations from those dissenters focusing on public dollars that were supposed to go to doctors who treat Medicaid patients. And there was a lawsuit that's been filed claiming some $330 million was diverted from those doctors, allegedly by President Wilson, to cover up red ink at Wayne State. What do we know about that allegation?
That it's just an allegation. If you listen to Wayne State, they say that it was nothing, it was money that was owed to them, that the physicians group hadn't paid, and they have asked the state to come in and do an audit of the books, and they feel that they'll be proved out that they did what was right. But again, this is all this giant mess, right? You've got people throwing accusations of misappropriating money, of making moves without consulting the board, and it's all just into this giant pot of turmoil that's going on at the board level there.
Have you heard any voices outside of the Board of Governors who see any merit in the complaints the dissidents have?
Not really. Wilson has rallied a bunch of support from the business community and from local pastors and people who know him. There are some of the physicians group who believe he is heavy-handed and has been trying to move some stuff away from what was traditionally theirs. He angered some folks when he went after revoking tenure to fire some longtime medical school professors who he said weren't producing up to the level that they should be. And so that plays into it as well.
And then overall, for people who haven't perhaps not been following the Wayne State situation very closely, what is the general take amongst the community on the job that President Wilson's doing?
We've heard lots of good, positive stuff. I mean, he has turned around graduation rates and retention rates at the school. It definitely seems to be on the upswing when you look at that. If you go into Midtown and you look around the campus, you know, there's a definite improvement in it. And so there's a bunch of folks that are happy with that. However, he has instituted a lot of change, and whenever you do a lot of change, that comes often with hurt feelings and people who feel that they're getting shoved aside. And so you're seeing that start to bubble up as well.
Compare and contrast for us, if you will, David, this war within Wayne State's Board of Governors and problems that we've been seeing within the Michigan State Board of Trustees, where we recently saw Trustee Nancy Schlichting saying, I'm done, I'm out, I'm stepping down. What do you see as similarities and what are the differences?
Well, the similarities is you have a bunch of board members who are on both boards who are trying to make change. So you have Wayne State, the people who are backing Wilson, who say, we brought Wilson, who is a medical doctor, in to do just this, to grab a hold of the medical school to make changes. And then at Michigan State, you have a handful of reformers who are saying, hey, look, at our board is broken, our university is broken, and it needs reform. We need to learn the lessons of the Larry Nassar scandal better, and as long as we're not being transparent, we're not going to do that. We need answers. And so in both boards, you have reformers who are trying to make change, and you have some old guard type folks who are trying to stay the course. I think that's more the case at Michigan State than it is at Wayne State. It seems to me at Wayne State there's a lot more personalities and egos at play than there necessarily is in Michigan State.
What's potential toll that these board squabbles could take on the image of the school and the level of education that students are seeking at both Michigan State and Wayne State?
Well, at Michigan State, you know, we're seeing it play out. If you say the word Michigan State to folks, you know, outside of East Lansing, certainly outside of Michigan, you know, the first thing they're going to talk about is the scandal, the board's reaction to that, the university's stonewalling, the fired president who's facing criminal charges. And so it just starts to hurt reputation there. At Wayne State, we haven't seen that yet, although we're starting to get there. And where it could really hurt is recruitment of not just students, but think about faculty. If you're a faculty member who is trying to come, do you want to come and work at a school, especially in the med school or related fields, for a board where you don't know what your direction's going to be, that is fighting? You know, if you're a student, can the board join together and keep tuition down? I mean, they just offered this free tuition. Is that program going to survive, or will there be a vote against it? And down the road, if Wilson leaves, either because he's sick of the mess or he gets fired, who is going to want to come into a board that's split 4-4 and going to have issues of trying to get anything done to move the school forward?
David Jesse, higher ed reporter for the Detroit Free Press. David, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Michigan ranks near the bottom nationally when it comes to connecting its more than 600,000 veterans to federal benefits. These are benefits that could change a vet's life, including access to health care, housing, and education, not to mention financial assistance. The need to connect more vets to benefits is what our next guest advised during the 2018 election campaign as one of the co-chairs of the Veterans for Whitmer Group. Stephanie Zarb is an Air Force veteran who served in the Middle East, including 53 combat missions over Afghanistan. She has directed a statewide nonprofit that assists Michigan vets. And she is with us now to assess how the governor has been doing on this Veterans Day. Stephanie, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So here we are, speaking on this Veterans Day, 10 months into Governor Whitmer's term. And as we noted, you were one of the advisors to the campaign regarding vets issues. If you could sum up how the governor has done so far in what one word, what would it be?
One word, that's pretty tough. If I could have two words, I'd say not great. We're really not there yet.
Okay, and first of all, what have you seen her do for veterans in these 10 months?
It was a little bit frustrating at first. You know, we had a really slow start. It took almost 6 months for a director of the Michigan Veteran Affairs Agency to be appointed. And we're 10 months in. We still don't have a strategic plan from the Michigan Veteran Affairs Agency. So right now, we don't really know where veteran services are going. And currently, under the budget line item veto situation, we saw some really critical programs for veterans get cut, while other programs, which maybe aren't as critical, maybe have a little bit of a troubled history, were allowed to stay. And so I think the question on most veterans' minds is, where is this going? What is the goal and what is the vision here? Because from a layperson's perspective, this really isn't making sense.
How does what you've seen in these 10 months contrast with what was promised during the campaign?
Well, I would say that we haven't really seen the promises that were made during the campaign be lived up to. I don't think that's unique to this administration. I don't think this is the first administration that's done that. Maybe one of the most telling issues was certainly during the campaign, there was a veteran tab on the website with the plan. There was not a veteran tab on the governor's website as of a few weeks ago. I probably should have checked this morning. So that's a little alarming in terms of prioritization. The other big issue is one of the big things that the Veterans for Whitmer group pushed during the campaign was this idea that Michigan veterans lag behind their peers in other states. We are less likely to have access to our benefits, and those who do get access to their benefits tend to do so at a lower rate than our peers in other states. And this is happening despite the fact that here in Michigan, we actually spend more on veteran programming than other states, which is really hard to kind of put your head around why that's happening. And so we tried to lay out for the governor a very clear plan of why that's happening and what these critical services were. And we felt like that's where we were headed. But with the budget line item veto situation, we actually saw those really critical programs get cut, and maybe not so much the programs that we said, you know, they're nice to have. If you have all the money in the world, sure. But if we're going to make some tough decisions, maybe these aren't the programs that can stay.
What got cut?
So the two specific programs that got cut that I'm referencing are the County Veteran Service Grants and the Buddy to Buddy Volunteer Veteran Program out of the University of Michigan. And what those two programs do and the reason why they are so important is those are the actual programs that connect our veterans to their federal benefits. And I think what a lot of people maybe don't understand is how the VA system works. Like, why are we even talking about the state when we talk about veteran benefits? Isn't that something that the VA does, federal kind of program? Well, the federal program runs the VA, which consists of the National Cemetery Administration, the Veterans Benefits Administration, and the Veterans Healthcare Administration. And a lot of people think that the Veterans Benefits Administration is who is responsible for helping veterans access their benefits. And so that's not actually what they do. We can think about the Veteran Benefits Administration. They're sort of like a judge. They rate claims. They look at what veterans have applied for, and they decide if veterans are eligible for service or not. It's actually not their job, and they're actually federally restricted from, in many ways, helping veterans write those claims. And that makes sense. You know, if you had a speeding ticket and you went in to see the judge, and the judge also happened to be your lawyer, you probably wouldn't feel so good about that situation. And the VBA is the same thing. The VBA is the judge. And so what state veteran agencies do is they provide a connection to what we call VA-accredited service officers. And they are the people that sit with veterans and help write these really complicated claims.
Help them figure this all out, because it can be confusing.
It is incredibly confusing. I am in my 22nd year of school, and I'm telling you, I don't have this figured out. And actually, federal law prohibits me from trying to help someone with a claim. only people with this accreditation are allowed to do it. And there's a few other people that can, but without going too far into the weeds.
But I would say, to be fair, it wasn't only veterans who were targeted in the vetoes. A lot of program literacy programs, the autism support services, some safety and policing programs were also cut in this standoff between the governor and the Republican legislature. So it's probably not as straightforward just as she doesn't like veterans.
Oh, no. I don't think that's what's happening at all here. And I think it's a really important distinction to make. So my problem is not that veteran programs got cut. In fact, like I said, we do spend more than other states. And as somebody who has a son on the spectrum, you know, if I have to make these decisions, I might make some decisions about cutting some veteran programs too. So my issue is not that veteran programming got cut. The problem is what got cut are the programs that help veterans connect to their benefits. And so it doesn't matter how good your other programs are, even if those programs find veterans, if they can't access a VA-accredited service officer to give them access to their federal benefits, those other programs aren't as important because only VA-accredited service officers can help veterans get access to their federal benefits. And only states provide that. So you can't do a private-public partnership. You can't go around and do all these other things. And, you know, really state veteran agencies, if you look across the United States, they do two things. They run veteran homes and they help veterans access their federal benefits. So why are those not the priorities of our state veteran agency? Or if they are, why don't we see a strategic plan explaining what we're going to do now that we who live in a state that lags behind all the other states have cut these last critical programs that help veterans connect? What is the plan going forward? And why were other programs allowed to stay? Programs that the Auditor General has put out reports saying that the amount of funding they're getting doesn't really match their effort. Programs which are known to have issues, or the fact that DHHS runs a set of veteran programs and the Michigan Veteran Affairs Agency run a set of programs. So you have two parts of government running veteran programs. Part of the mandate of the Michigan Veteran Affairs Agency is to bring all veteran programming under one roof. So when you have these two separate parts of government running state programs, you have some overlap, you have a lot of administrative overhead. Isn't there another way to work this without cutting these really critical links to federal benefits? It just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
Why are we at such a critical moment for veterans in Michigan? I can tell just from your words and looking at you that you really do believe this. Why?
I think one thing that a lot of people are surprised to learn is that Michigan has the 11th highest population of veterans in the country. But one thing that makes our veteran population really unique is the majority of our veterans are Vietnam-era veterans. These are people who served during Vietnam. I think most of us would say we failed them when they came home, and we have continued to fail them for 50 years. And I've always felt it's never too late to do the right thing, but the truth is it's starting to become too late. We're seeing these veterans who have suffered not only from the trauma of war, from exposure to Agent Orange, from different diseases that exist in the jungle, malaria, things the VA is really specifically designed to deal with. Your civilian doctor maybe doesn't have as much experience in that area. And so this is really a critical time. Our Vietnam veterans, even if you were, you know, in the last year, 1975, the last year of Vietnam, you're reaching your 60s. If not now, then when? We really can't wait for Michigan to catch up. Michigan's been failing veterans for a long time. The governor, through these powers, has demonstrated that she has the ability to set this agenda. And I would just really love to see her do the right thing and take care of our veterans.
Last month, the MVAA leadership embarked on a 13-stop listening tour, and the stated goals were to make sure veterans are heard and questions are answered and get more of Michigan's nearly 600,000 military vets connected to federal benefits. And we've been talking about the importance of that, connecting vets to the benefits before, now, and earlier on this show. Is the MVAA's focus in the right place here?
You know, it's difficult because we have a new director, and I certainly commend, understand, and think veterans need to be heard. But a few years ago, the state of Michigan expended $4 million to do a listening tour and do the same thing. Those reports are freely and publicly available. And I think that while this is an important initiative, these questions have been asked and they've been answered. And our Vietnam veterans really don't have the time to go through a whole nother cycle. Now, our new director, I think she's great. I think she's taking the agency in the right direction. I think she's made some wonderful moves. We just don't have time to do this again. The information is out there and it's available. And for our Michigan veterans that are sleeping on the streets tonight, not because the federal government doesn't have a program, a Housing First program that can get them off the streets, but because the state has failed to make that connection for them, this is going to be a hard winter, and I just think we're running out of time.
Air Force veteran Stephanie Zarb, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We offered Governor Whitmer's office an opportunity to respond, and we did not hear back. After the break, one of the last living Tuskegee Airmen talks about his service and discrimination during Jim Crow. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Veterans Day, we're revisiting my conversation with retired Lieutenant Colonel Harry T. Stewart, Jr. The 95-year-old Bloomfield Hills man is one of the few living Tuskegee Airmen, men who flew combat missions in World War II, African-American pilots. His life is the subject of a book published this summer, co-authored by aviation writer Philip Handelman. It's called Soaring to Glory, a Tuskegee Airman's firsthand account of World War II. I spoke with Colonel Stewart earlier this year about his life and his service. Colonel Stewart, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
It's a pleasure being here.
So you flew 43 combat missions, awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, a Congressional Gold Medal for your valor with the 332nd Fighter Group, the Red Tails. Going back earlier, what are your first memories of seeing aircraft and being called to fly them?
Well, my parents told me. I was born in Newport News, Virginia, and we lived not too far from a Army airfield in Newport News by the name of Langley Field. My parents used to put me out in the crib in the daytime to sun me, and they told me that when the planes would fly over, I would look up and Google at the planes and coo along, that type of thing, and like I wanted to be up there with the pilots. And around 2 years old, my parents, we all moved the family to Queens in New York, about a mile and a half from an airport by the name of North Beach Airport. That today is now LaGuardia Airport. But I used to go over as a teenager and sit near the airport and just watch the planes fly and fantasize that I was up there with them in the cockpit flying the plane along. So I think that was my initiation, or those were my initiations in wanting to become a pilot.
And, of course, the chances of an African-American being able to fly were pretty limited until the door opened with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And then earlier that year, the Army decided it would train, and I'm going to use the parlance of the day, an all-Negro flying unit. And we should remember, in World War I, the Army had refused to even consider allowing blacks to even be aerial observers. But they opened that door, and you volunteered for the Army Air Corps on your 18th birthday. But I read in the book, as a little boy, you'd had polio and a heart murmur. How'd you clear that physical?
Well, I sort of hid them from discovery by the doctors there. I know that when I went in to take my physical, as far as my leg was concerned, my right leg, which had a slight paralysis in the calf muscle, and I had no Achilles reflex. And when the doctor went to hit the Achilles tendon with his mallet there, I almost kicked the mallet out of his hand. So he assumed that everything must have been all right as far as my leg was concerned. As far as the heart was concerned, I was within a line of inductees at the time there, and they had a couple of doctors who were just walking along listening to the hearts of the future soldiers that stood there. And the one that came to my heart, he listened, and he took some time to listen again, and then he called the other doctor over, and he said, "Say, listen to this." And the other doctor came over and listened, and he said, "It's all right." And that was it.
So you pass the physical, you leave Queens for basic training in Biloxi, Mississippi, and then flight training in Tuskegee, Alabama. And as we see in this book, Soaring to Glory, what a change for a man of color who'd grown up in Queens. Tell us about those first times when you came up against Jim Crow. What happened, and how did you choose to react?
Well, the first time was when I got on the Penn Station, New York, to go down to, Biloxi, Mississippi. And when we got to Washington, the conductor came into the car that I was in, and I happened to be with some kids from my neighborhood at the time. They were white, and the conductor pointed to me, and he said, you go up to the Jim Crow car in the front. So my parents had warned me about this and told me that there was institutional segregation in the South, and that when I passed the Mason-Dixon line that runs through Washington there, that I would be relegated to a question of integration and segregation, I should say. But anyway, the fellas that were with me, they said, well, Harry, we'll go up front with you. And the conductor says, no, no, you don't. He said, that's the car for the Negro people. And I didn't make an argument. I just went up front. But I think in incidents like that and further incidents that were to come along, I just kept my eye on the prize, and the prize being getting my wings as a Air Corps pilot. And that was about it.
You stayed focused. And it was very stunning to read about your first, you know, there was your first flight in an open cockpit. You were in that PT-19 trainer and flying over Alabama fields where your grandfather had been born into slavery.
Yes, he was born in 1863. And it was quite a sensation to be flying up over near Montgomery, Alabama, where he was born. And that was my first solo and my first introduction to flight. I had never been up in an aircraft before. And it was quite an experience.
The book makes it very, very clear, Colonel Stewart. Training was tough. Your class started with 75 cadets. Only 26 made it to the end. But on June 27th, 1944, you were commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army Air Forces. You were 19 years old, and you didn't even have a driver's license.
Being from New York, you know, you really didn't need a car. The family didn't have a car, so I didn't know how to drive.
But you were a flyer, and they sent you to Italy to be deployed with the now legendary 332nd Fighter Group, the Red Tails. Colonel Stewart, if you could, would you just listen for a moment? And I want you to tell me if this tune rings a bell for you.
All right.
Why you keep fooling little coquette, making fun of the ones who love you, breaking.
Do you recognize that song?
I do. You're bringing tears to my eyes. And anyway, Little Coquette, and that was Guy Lombardo, I believe.
It was.
Was playing that rendition of it. There was one other orchestra played a rendition of it also. It was Duke Ellington.
Yes.
But
why is that song special to you?
I just loved it. That's all. I loved the tune. And I don't know. There was something about the tune that I liked. I didn't have a girlfriend at the time. So when it came to putting the nose art on my aircraft there, I decided to go ahead and have them put Little Coquette as the nose art, and that was it. That's what I had on my aircraft.
Your brand new P-51D Mustang. And if you've just joined us, I am speaking with one of the last surviving members of the legendary Tuskegee Airmen, Lieutenant Colonel Harry Stewart, Jr. Aviation writer Philip Handelman's latest book, Soaring to Glory, tells us the story of Colonel Stewart's life. You know, sir, I've known a number of B-17 flyboys through my time volunteering for Honor Flight. Some were POWs, and to a man, they said, if you found yourself on the ground in German territory, you wanted to find German soldiers because civilians were much more dangerous to a downed American flyer. And you lost a friend that way, didn't you?
Yes, we did. It was April 1st of 1945. Incidentally, that happened to be Easter Sunday and also April Fool's Day, but we had just completed escorting bombers up into Austria, and The bombers were started heading back home, and a contingent of the escort that I was in there, a contingent of seven planes, were ordered to perform a fighter sweep in the area. This was around the Danube and Linz, Austria, Wels, Austria, and not too far from Vienna. But anyway, fighter sweep was to destroy any rolling stock that we saw on the ground, river barges, and enemy aircraft, if possible. And this was all to make it more difficult as far as, or bring the war to a speedy conclusion. Anyway, to make a long story short, we were attacked by a large group of German aircraft. They were fighter planes, FW-190Ds. Three of the seven of us, got shot down. One managed to take his crippled plane to friendly territory in Yugoslavia. The second, he was instantly killed when he was shot down. The third, his name was Walter Manning. He was from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He was able to bail out of his aircraft, but as soon as he alighted in his parachute, he was captured by a mob and delivered to the local jailhouse in Linz, Austria there. About two nights later, in fact, exactly two nights later, another mob formed and broke into the jail, took Walter Manning out of the jail, beat him up pretty severely, but then they lynched him from a lamppost in the street. And it wasn't that he was the only one that that had happened to,
yeah.
But as you said, and as you introduced that story there, is that it was a dangerous thing for anybody to bail out or near the area where not only the bombing had occurred, but also where the civilian populace had control there. It would be better to be captured by one of the military personnel.
And I know it was also on that day you flew the mission that earned you the Distinguished Flying Cross. You downed three German fighter planes in that one mission. You were honorably discharged from active duty in 1950. You were 25. You had hundreds of flight hours. You're a decorated war hero. You know, you had helped to defeat the Nazis, and you wanted to be a commercial pilot. Can you briefly tell us what happened when you presented yourself to Pan Am and TWA?
Yes, I was just summarily dismissed as not being qualified by virtue of the fact that I was African-American. One of the companies said outright that they just weren't accepting black individuals as air crew members. Which was not true, because I had just read, I think the day before, a small advertisement in the paper that they were looking for pilots to train. The other company, I think it was the vice president of personnel, came out and tried to rationalize why they would not accept me, and he used the reasoning or the rationale that the passengers would be extremely upset to see a black man walking down the aisle and getting into the cockpit and taking the plane off. That feeling and situation prevailed, you know, for a couple of years, and then I will say that the airlines relented and they gradually started accepting African Americans as crew members, as pilots, and
but by then you'd moved on.
I had moved on then,
yeah.
But you know, bringing it up till to today, in every major airline that we have in the country, we have blacks flying in the cockpit there as pilots and co-pilots, also air crew members, your carriers or such as UPS and FedEx. They have a large contingent of black crew members. And I mentioned bringing tears to my eyes when you were playing Little Coquette, but brought tears to my eyes when I was taking a trip a couple of years ago and leaving Detroit here, the metro airport, going somewhere, I can't remember where, but anyway, when I entered the plane, I looked into the cockpit there, and there were two African-American pilots. One was the co-pilot, and one was the pilot. But not only that, the thing that started bringing the tears to my eyes is they were both female.
Wow. So you can assume the mantle of trailblazer. Then we also see in the book amends were made in later years. You were made an honorary pilot by Delta and American Airlines.
That's
and
right.
Also, it was a very, very powerful moment in the book Soaring to Glory, March 2007. The Tuskegee Airmen were presented the Congressional Gold Medal by President George W. Bush, of course, himself the son of a war pilot, and reading about the president saluting all of you is that brought tears to my eyes. But
yes,
the question,
yes.
How did that feel to you at that moment?
Well, it was, I can hardly, just awesome. The president, you know, stood back and he was, you know, apologizing for the way the nation had treated its black citizens during the war there. And he says, I even understand that, you know, even you as officers had terrible events where you were not even saluted at times by the white soldiers there. And he says, but I want to make amends as far as that's concerned. And he stood back and drew himself up to full attention and threw up his right arm and saluted the group that was in front of him there.
Mm. You know, speaking of making amends, were you among the many, many black veterans who did not get any of the benefits promised by the GI Bill?
No, I did get all the benefits, so I did not fall in that category, but I certainly think that's, you know, horrifying that there were those men who sacrificed the way that they did, and they did not get their just reward for it.
Yes, and I know you went on to become a mechanical engineer and did very well.
Well, that's right. When I found out that I couldn't meet my dream as far as an airline pilot was concerned, I was running out of time as far as age was concerned. I decided to go to a fallback position, which, well, anyway, I went to New York University, got my degree in mechanical engineering, and went up the corporate ladder from there. And I found it very gratifying, and I eventually retired as vice president of a oil and gas consortium right in Detroit here.
Colonel Stewart, what are your thoughts and your feelings on the love and the affection and gratitude that's being shown to those of you who have been dubbed the greatest generation?
Well, it's well appreciated because it was sort of a come down at the end of the war, I think. But then a lot of those feelings were resurrected, especially with the in the case of the Tuskegee Airmen, there were two movie films that came out. One was an HBO film by the name of The Tuskegee Airmen, and the other was a George Lucas film by the name of The Red Tails.
Well, and it's probably worth mentioning that the Tuskegee Airmen National Museum is on Jefferson Avenue in Detroit, right here in Michigan, and it's certainly worth seeing. And I have to say it is very much worth reading the book on your life, Soaring to Glory, a Tuskegee Airmen's firsthand account of World War II, written by Philip Handelman, along with my guest, Lieutenant Colonel Harry T. Stewart, Jr. Sir, it has been a pleasure to talk with you and to say from the bottom of everyone's hearts, thank you for your service.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Tell me why you keep fooling little coquette, making fun of the ones who love you.